Hello, all of you out there in Radio Land. You're listening to KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. For virtual listeners, we hope your device stays locked onto our website at kptz.org. I'm Marianne McNellis, and this show is called Our Town. The show highlights some of the diverse personalities that make Jefferson County, Washington so very special. Our Town profiles people from all walks of life, from firefighters to foodies, from bus drivers to baristas, and even the lawyers and the ladies who lunch. My next guest is someone who mainly eats lunch at the company cafeteria in an outfit that looks something like his pajamas. Have you guessed his position from those clues? My next guest is a doctor from Jefferson Healthcare. Of course, he mainly eats his lunch in the hospital cafeteria when not munching it at his desk reviewing patient records and x-rays. My guest today is Dr. Joseph Meyerson, a surgeon at Jefferson Healthcare who specializes in both hand surgery and plastic surgery. So welcome to Our Town, Dr. Meyerson.
Thanks so much.
I'm delighted you're taking time to talk with us here at KPTZ. Before we go on to the somewhat mysterious topic of plastic surgery, let's give our listeners a little bit of background about who you are and where you came from. Are you a local boy born and bred on the Olympic Peninsula?
Yeah, so I was originally raised in Edmonds, so just down the road.
That's close.
Yeah, spent some time coming out here growing up, but, you know, born and raised really in Edmonds and stayed there from, you know, being born to 18 and then moved out from there.
So what'd your folks do?
Mom was stay-at-home mom. I have three older brothers. And dad was basically worked himself up from the base of Time Life, so at telemarketing. And after years of kind of advancing up there, worked into the position of vice president of telemarketing at Time Life.
Okay, so you're the fourth of four boys. Did any of them go into medicine?
No one in the family in medicine. Huh. Everyone kind of has a different career plan, but yeah, no one in medicine.
Okay. I always like to ask a bit about teenage years because they're very formative. You go from being technically a boy to a man in high school. And some kids are really clear, even from that age, about what they want to do when they grow up. Were you?
Yeah, right around 12, 13, I realized I loved animals and I loved science. And those kind of came together for the thought that I should be a veterinarian. And right at that age, I decided that's what I was going to be. And with just the support of, you know, parents saying, that's a great, you know, career path. Let's, you know, you should do that. And so from that point on, that was the plan. And I was sure that I was going to be a veterinarian, you know, starting at 13.
Wow. And so where'd you go to school?
So went to high school in Seattle. High school is called University Prep. And then I went off to Washington State University. That was actually the only place I applied to because it had a really strong veterinary program. And so it was in state, it was nearby, and I knew about it. So that's where I ended up going for college.
Okay. And did you end up getting a degree in veterinary science?
Yeah. So that was the interesting thing. When you applied there, you could decide on what you wanted to major in, and all of those majors led down the track to be eventually becoming a veterinarian. Mm-hmm. And so there was really three main ones. There was animal science, biology, and neuroscience. And really, I just picked out of the ones that interest me, so I became a neuroscience major on the track to becoming a veterinarian.
Hmm. So you got your undergraduate degree in veterinarian science, and you went on?
Yeah, so I basically decided very early that, okay, I love neuroscience. I love the study of the brain. It was an interesting major. I had a lot of different parts to that field. But then I realized, well, maybe I wanted to be a neurosurgeon, maybe even a veterinarian neurosurgeon, but that doesn't really exist, or I didn't think it did at that time. So very early on in my education in college, I decided, okay, maybe I should go to medicine instead. And that's very quickly turned in my freshman year into, instead of the pre-vet track, I went into the pre-med track.
It's sort of similar. I mean, they head you in the same direction,
yeah, absolutely,
right?
Yeah. It wasn't really a big change other than to say, I want to go this way and that way.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't know exactly how many years it takes, but I'm really aware that to become a doctor of any sort, there's quite a long study path there. So where did you go?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the medical training, regardless of what field you end up in, you're going to do 4 years of college, undergraduate, 4 years of medical school, and then an additional period of training, depending on what path you go into. So I opted to go into medicine. So I graduated from Washington State and then moved to basically where I applied in terms of medical school, which I went to Ohio State for medical school and spent 4 years in medical school there. And then at the end of that, I decided that I was going to go into plastic surgery. And that led to me applying to plastic surgery residencies, which is approximately 6 years.
Okay. So why Ohio State? What attracted you there?
There was a few things. I mean, so through the interview process, you apply to these places, decide which ones you're going to interview at. You go interview and they offer you an applicant spot. And Ohio State just had a very strong kind of broad program. Additionally, one thing that was intriguing is that after your first year, they give you in-state tuition too. So there was a financial kind of benefit there as well. And it kind of all came together at a good time to try something different, be somewhere different.
Yeah. It's good to experience something outside of your hometown.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you sort of mentioned something very important. Going to university and grad school in whatever field is very expensive. I'm guessing you racked up a fair amount of student debt.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the process of medical school, not only are you paying tuitions, which are extremely high, but also paying for living expenses while you're there, because it's really difficult to have an income while you're studying and in the process of getting that degree. And so, yeah, the final, you know, outcome is an extremely high bill to become a doctor for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So now that you're a practicing doctor, I assume you're on the payment track. Do you have any rough estimate when you might be able to pay it off?
Yeah. And it's a relative, process, right? The more you put away towards it, the faster you pay it off, and the less you do, the longer it takes. You know, the benefit of being in such a long track, especially in residency, is there are programs out there, probably a lot in the news now lately, but there's a forgiveness program based upon being in a public sector in terms of where you're working. Uh-huh. And so part of training and part of actually coming here to Jefferson County has the ability to allow my loans to be forgiven if you work there for a long enough period, which is 10 years total. Okay. So you can have that all forgiven, you know, if you continue on that track and make payments as you go along.
Right. Well, when we were talking before, you explained to me that Jefferson Healthcare is what you called a critical access hospital. And that's a term I hadn't heard before. And I bet a lot of our listeners haven't heard it. So can you explain what that means?
Yeah. So a critical access hospital is effectively, at its base meaning, it's a 25-bed hospital. So it's a very small, in fact, the smallest hospital that exists. But the purpose of it is to provide care to a area that may not have local care otherwise. And you have to travel, you know, outside the region to get it. And so it's deemed a critical need for that community. And so Jefferson Healthcare's hospital is in this community because of that need is defined, you know, by essentially a government body.
So therefore, it's a rural hospital, but it's not just a rural hospital. It's a critical access hospital.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, a critical access hospital is always going to be typically rural, but there can be other, you know, for-profit hospitals in those regions. But this one is essentially defined and assisted from a government standpoint.
Okay. Now, a little while ago, you said you had 6 years for the plastic surgeon residency. That's in addition to 8 years?
Correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of school.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And where did you do the plastic surgeon part of it?
So in the end of your training in medical school, you start to decide what you're interested in, what you may want to go in. And again, as you decide which type of field, they have different lengths and period of training that's required after your 8 years or after your medical school. Plastic surgery residency's 6. And so I applied truly throughout the nation because there's not very many programs.
Yeah.
And I actually ended up staying at Ohio State for those 6 additional years.
You were there a long time.
Yeah, a decade in total, right.
Got to really know the place.
Huh? Yes, I did, having not known where what to think about it before, yeah.
Okay, and did you finish all your training there, or did you go elsewhere?
Yeah, so after my 6 additional years in plastics residency, I then did an additional year in hand surgery fellowship, and I did that at Baylor in Houston, Texas. Mm-hmm.
So how did you actually end up here in Port Townsend?
That was kind of goes back to a part of my training. You know, when you're in plastic surgery residency, it encompasses all of plastic surgery, which is a really broad field. It's hand surgery, burn surgery, you know, pediatric surgery like cleft lip and palate, microsurgery, cosmetic surgery. So there's all these parts of this field that you could technically specialize into. And part of that, especially in your later years, your fifth and sixth years, you can start to do electives and kind of get a feel for what you may want to do as a practice.
Right.
I was lucky enough to meet a plastic surgeon from Coos Bay, Oregon, which is a rural designated area, and do a rotation with him in my later parts of training and realize there is a whole field of plastic surgery that really allowed you to do a wider gamut or a broader kind of experience in terms of what you're doing for patients. And that's what led me to realize that, oh, I can have a strong impact, have a broad practice, and really benefit a community that never had a plastic surgeon in it before. And so that's what stemmed my searching for a place that I could do that.
Well, most people, when they hear the term plastic surgery, they think of facelifts or breast reductions or augmentations, but there's a lot more to it. Can you define that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, a lot of times people ask me where plastics comes from, and sometimes they think of it as fake or, you know, plastic like implants, like mm-hmm. breast implants. And the thing about plastics, the term, it actually comes from Greek, and the origin being plastiques, right? Which it means malleable or changeable, essentially. And that's really what we do in plastic surgery. We use techniques to change tissue, move tissue in a flexible way. And so when I think about plastic surgery, I think about it from that term, right? And I actually had a professor who I really liked describe plastic surgery, which it's on a spectrum. If you take a normal aesthetic person and you deform them somehow with cancer or trauma, and you try to get them back to their original self, that's reconstructive surgery. Now, if you take that same person and say, I want to augment with a facelift or breast implants or something like that, then you're in the cosmetic realm of plastic surgery. And it's all on a continuum of what you are doing for that patient. So it's all encompassing of everything we do in plastic surgery. It just depends on what you're doing it for.
So in fact, you mentioned you don't do cosmetic surgery, but you do things on the spectrum of cosmetic surgery. Is that how you would describe it?
That's exactly right. So, I mean, one example of a surgery that I do quite frequently is a breast reduction. And in fact, I often have difficulty getting insurance coverage for it because insurance sometimes deems that as possibly a cosmetic procedure that's not necessary. And we do breast reductions because if the breasts are that heavy, the patient has neck pain and back pain and issues with it. And so by reducing the breasts, it can relieve those chronic issues. But the technique is the same as if I was doing it for a cosmetic reason, which is very similar to a breast lift from an aesthetic standpoint. So the principle of the surgery is done in the exact same fashion, but the purpose is different, whether you're doing it to augment something cosmetically or you're doing it reconstructively to assist someone's chronic pain.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, can you sort of tell us about some of the things you might be doing? I want to refer to the one you told me about noses. And what really took me by surprise is one of the things you said was the surgical technique has been around since, was it 800 AD?
BC.
Oh, 800 BC. Okay, yeah. Can you describe this?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this was, again, you know, this is why I love my practice here is a lot of times when you're in a bigger city, you're sort of pigeonholed or you have a niche that you fill because you specialize in one thing. I have the ability to do a lot of different surgeries through my training and through my expertise from that. And getting to do these here is really why I love working here. So not only do I do hand surgery and breast surgery, but another common procedure I do is facial reconstruction after skin cancer. Oftentimes, because you're in the sun, you have a cancer that may occur on your nose. And once the skin cancer is removed, you're left with the resulting defect. And so this procedure that we had talked about is essentially a reconstruction of the nose using either cheek or forehead skin and rotating into position to replace the skin that has been removed from the cancer. Because oftentimes there's not enough skin on the nose or in the region nearby to reconstruct it. And the interesting thing about it is it described in ancient India, when at that time there were people, essentially the criminals would be punished by having their nose amputated so that, you know, everyone would know that they were a criminal. And so the way they had people basically assisting them is the surgeon would reconstruct their nose using this technique, which is exactly the same as we do today, by rotating this skin onto the nose for approximately a month, leaving it in place, letting the nose blood supply grow into that tissue, and then you can separate it and effectively transplant that cheek or that forehead skin, and then use it essentially like clay, and then mold that to the nose by, you know, surgical techniques.
And can it actually function as a nose?
Absolutely. I mean, so it depends on what you lose when you have these cancers. But if you lose the skin, then you need to replace the skin. If you lose the cartilage, you need to replace the cartilage. And the nose itself is kind of this building architecture where you have to bottom up. You have to make sure the mucosa is reconstructed, then the cartilage, then the skin. And so you just work your way up with what's been lost from the trauma, the cancer, whatever it may be.
Huh. Amazing. 800 BC.
Exactly.
So what happens to the cheek? You know, you take the skin, big hole left there?
Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of the essence of plastics is taking a piece of skin and then reconstructing back where you did that, you know, where you took that skin. With the cheek and the forehead, there's actually quite a bit of laxity. So you can essentially shift the cheek skin over. So a lot of times if I'm doing one, it's called a nasolabial flap, but it's basically in the crease of your cheek and your lip. And oftentimes that scar is just hidden right in that crease, and we're able to take all of the rest of the tissue to transplant to the nose.
Huh, amazing. So what about 3D printers? Where does this come into play, or where will it come into play?
Yeah, I think that's kind of a futuristic outlook, but it honestly is probably where at some point we'll head with plastic surgery, because a lot of times what we're missing in plastic surgery is critical structures, critical pieces of tissue that oftentimes we have to steal from somewhere else. So with 3D printers, you know, right now, very popular portion of 3D printing is using it to print prosthetics like a nose or an ear that you put into place, but it's not actual tissue. The growing of cartilage cells or skin cells in the lab, and then using that basically to make a ear or make a nose and print it in a laboratory and then be able to transplant it is probably at some point where we're headed, I think, with plastic surgery. Right now we're using plastics to print, but that soon will be, you know, hopefully cells and other structures that we can make.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I know you can't read your crystal ball on this, but are we talking a couple of years or a couple of decades?
Who knows, to be honest with you. Interestingly, there are products out there already where, you know, if someone has a horrific burn, you know, oftentimes we do skin grafting, which people right. understand. If they have so much burn that they lose essentially most of the skin, one of the methods that is actually used today is you take a portion of that skin, grow it in a lab, and they're able to grow sheets of that patient's own epithelial cells or skin cells, and then you can use that as a skin graft, oftentimes for people who have really massive burns. But so the techniques are actually being used now. The complexity of like building a nose with all of the different cells and all of that, that's probably quite a ways away, but it's not too far off.
Huh. What about ears?
Ears, same thing, right? Cartilage, skin. The way we do it now is we actually take costal cartilage or rib cartilage, remove it from the rib, carve it into what looks like this the cartilage structure of an ear, tuck it behind the ear, and patients who don't have an ear or weren't born with an ear, let it take inside that pocket of skin, and now you effectively have what looks like cartilage underneath the skin, and then you can do other techniques to lift the skin and make it so that it doesn't look like a plastered down ear, but it actually lifts up. Usually 2, 3, you know, 4 surgeries sometimes, often when a child's relatively young, is most common technique. But you never know when at some point we'll just be able to grow in a lab and put it on.
Wow. So do you do a lot of pediatric surgery then?
I actually do very little. There's multiple reasons for that, but one is just from an anesthetic standpoint and just the care that pediatrics takes. And it's just a different patient population. I would say that out of my entire practice, that is the thing that I really don't do much of for lots of different reasons. But it, for better or worse, the patient population in Port Townsend tends to be of an older age.
Yeah. I think anyone who walks around town could figure that out.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Well, another surgery you mentioned to me was, and this one really sounded weird to me, a scalp reattachment or
Yeah.
I don't know where you find scalped people, but, you know.
Well, yeah, this was actually back in my training, but there was a patient who had a... worked at a factory that had a rolling press, and her hair got caught in the press, and it literally tore her scalp off from her eyebrows to the back of her head.
Oh my God.
One of the techniques that you learn in plastic surgery is microsurgery, which means you're sewing blood vessels, the size of spaghetti together underneath a microscope. And so when you have a scalp torn off, the original, or I should say the only option before microsurgery was essentially to let the skin heal and put a skin graft or something like that. But now that patient's effectively bald and obviously not a cosmetic outcome. So using that patient's scalp, was able to trace the blood vessels that supply the scalp that were torn from the rest of the head and sew those together underneath a microscope to transplant the skin back on.
Wow. Well, you have some pretty high-tech equipment. Tell us about a little bit about what you've got.
Yeah, I don't think I'll be doing much scalp replacements, but same techniques, right? So using, when I say microsurgery, what that looks like is you're using a microscope, a surgical microscope that comes into the field when you're operating. It magnifies it 25 times, even more for some microscopes. It allows you to see the blood vessels or the nerves and reconnect them using what is suture, but the suture is a needle the size of an eyelash and the thread is about the size of a hair, depending on how thick or thin you need it to be, and repair the tissues underneath the microscope together at a microscopic level.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And it's something that, you know, we tend to do a lot with, digital nerve injuries and table saw injuries if there's a damage to those nerves.
Okay. So what would be some other common type things that you would be involved in?
Yeah, and I think we've talked a lot about the plastic side of things, and those are really the main ones, breast surgery, facial reconstruction surgery. I'd say a good portion, if not the majority of what I do is hand surgery. So anything from traumatic injuries to broken bones, and also just chronic issues like arthritis or tendonitis or carpal tunnel and nerve compression type injuries. Those I see in great numbers, especially in our community.
Yeah. So how does it work at Jefferson Healthcare? Do other doctors refer people to you, or do they call you in to look at a patient, let's say a dermatologist?
Yeah, it comes in all waves and from all avenues. Sometimes patients just call because they have an issue that they, with their hand or whatnot, and call the office directly. A lot of times it comes from their primary care doctors referring to me, sometimes through the emergency room as a referral, or like you said, specialists like dermatology, depending on what the problem is, but really from all avenues.
Okay, so you've been with Jefferson Healthcare since 2018, I believe?
Yeah, 2019.
And looking down the road, where do you see yourself?
Yeah, from a practice standpoint, hopefully continuing on the trajectory that we have, which is continuing to be growing plastic surgery and taking care of everything that kind of is reasonable to cover from a plastic surgery standpoint. My practice has included the addition of a PA who works with me full time. And then additionally, because of the number of surgeries that I have and sort of the time that it's taking to even get to them, because I'm so backlogged, of addition of another plastic surgeon would be wonderful.
Wow. I guess there's a lot of demand in a community like this.
Yeah, and that's kind of the principle from a plastic surgery. We tend to be, we operate from head to toe. And as you can imagine, there's a number of issues from head to toe that can occur. And so the ability to touch all of those really make a plastic surgeon, especially in a small or rural community, a critical person to be involved in medical care, and it's not very common at all, to be honest.
Well, I can see you have a great diversity. If you were in Manhattan or whatever, you know, you were part of a group, you'd end up there. There'd be the breast guy and the nose guy. And the, you
know, it's exactly true. And there, I mean, there's some benefit to that, but then you start to lose the techniques that you develop throughout your career, and you start to just be known for the one thing instead of having a broad spectrum to your practice. Yeah.
Okay, we're running real short on time, but I did want to get in a little bit about the fact that you're not just an obsessed surgeon. You actually have a wife. Yeah. And, you know, it's hard to imagine how you picked her up along the way because you were in school for so long. So how did you meet her?
Yeah, so we actually met in college on our pre-science floor. So on that floor, you could be pre-vet, pre-med, pre-pharmacy. And my wife, Lisa, is actually a pharmacist by training. And so we went through schooling really, you know, together through that.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. You know, doctors don't have a lot of time for multiple dating. So I'm glad that worked out for you.
Me too.
So you must have at least a little bit of time off. Do you hike? Do you sail? What do you do?
Yeah, you know, always been a passion for outdoors, hiking, you know, fishing, crabbing, clamming. That's really what drew me to Port Townsend in general. I grew up doing those kind of things, and it's been great to really live it and be in it and not have to, you know, vacation to it.
Right, and your family's nearby, so all of that's good.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you for being on the show, Dr. Meyerson. You've been listening to Our Town on KPTZ Port Townsend 91.9 FM. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis. My guest today has been Dr. Joseph Meyerson, who's a hand surgeon and plastic surgeon at Jefferson Healthcare. Again, thank you so much for being on the show. And thank you, the listener, loyal fans of KPTZ. It's been an amazing decade plus for this hearty little community radio station, so keep listening. Show's called Our Town. I'm your host, Marianne McNellis, signing off for today, but please stay tuned to KPTZ Port Townsend for more dynamic, eclectic community radio.
Our Town is an original KPTZ production, created by Marianne McNellis and edited by Taylor Clark.